welcome into episode 17 of the Calcio Connection podcast, connecting with you, Italian football fans from all over the world. And our worlds will be colliding on this episode. We'll be talking some Premier League in addition to Serie A. We'll introduce our special guest in just a moment. I am Alex Dono, alongside, as always, my co-host, Jerry Mancini. Jerry, how are you, sir? Are you staying safe and healthy in quarantine?
I actually am, and I was watching Ozark last night, and I'm almost done season two, and I can't believe Marty killed the priest. My God, or the preacher, or whatever his name was. I forgot now, but you think that Marty's not a killer, and all of a sudden he's killing people. I'm sorry if for those who haven't watched the show, but you would have to watch it to actually understand what I'm talking about for those who haven't watched it. But it is a show that you just think that, okay, you know what's going on, and all of a sudden, bang. And then the two hillbilly guys, the girl and the wife, got freaking shot to death by the Mexicans.
The cartel.
The cartel, thank you. And I didn't see that coming either. And then I watched a 1987 Edmonton Oilers versus Philadelphia Flyers game last night. What a difference in sports. Back in the 80s, I saw like five people in that game, okay, wearing jerseys. And you look at a game today and the fan base, it's all jerseys. You go to a hockey game or a football game or an American football game, and it's all predominantly jerseys representing their club now. What a transition of the fan base and how it has changed over the decades. But today I'm very, very excited, Alex. Very excited because we got a gentleman whose work is great, awesome, and really represents Chelsea to the best, I have to say.
Yeah, and that's what I say when I'm talking about worlds colliding, because our special guest today, of course, very into Chelsea, hosts an excellent podcast called The Byline. And he's also, this is how he creeps into the Serie A world as well and does a great job. He's the co-host and producer of the Calcioland pod that he does with our friend David Amoyal. And these guys do an awesome job. It's one of my favorite pods. The great Alex Goldberg joins us. Alex, how are you? And I hope you and your family, including your seven-month-old, are very safe and healthy during this time.
I appreciate that, Alex. We're good. We're good. It's good to be on the line with you and Jerry, two people who I think very highly of. I know David does as well. And awesome representees of a Calcioland listener. So it's nice to finally connect with you guys on a podcast other than Calcioland. And yeah, I'm excited for this chat.
Yeah, I know Jerry's very excited about your work, as he supports Chelsea in addition to Lazio. You've actually like raised my Chelsea awareness. Like hearing you talk so much Chelsea on Calcioland has actually made me pay a lot more attention to that club. And something I'm curious about, Alex, I want to start with this. As someone who's really watched a lot of Serie A in recent years, and you've got your Premier League ties, if someone who's accustomed to watching the Premier League asks you why they should give Serie A a chance, because I know a lot of people like that who, you know, watch Premier League every weekend on NBC, don't watch much Serie A. If somebody comes to you asking why they should give Serie A a shot, what would you tell them?
It's a great question. The first part of my answer is simplistic. It's a good league. It's a good, good league. And the second part is kind of a parallel, if you will. There's a lot of history in Serie A. I'm not saying there isn't in other leagues, but there's a lot of history in Serie A, and I know Premier League or English football fans can relate to that, where football is almost your religion. I mean, that is definitely a big thing in Serie A for diehard fans of their club. So those are almost non-footballing reasons, but harping on saying it's a good league, I mean, it's a good, good product of football, where I think you're seeing now a lot more. Even mid-table teams have perhaps specific players that really catch your eye, and it's not just based on one powerhouse. Now, I know someone could say in response, or a Premier League fan who doesn't really watch but watches the table could say, no, it is one powerhouse. It's just Juve winning Scudetto after Scudetto after Scudetto. But that really doesn't tell the full story. I mean, it seems like there's always a changing powerhouse each year. really trying to knock Juve off, but it feels legitimate in the fact that there are consistent top teams. Then there are kind of similar to the Premier League with your Arsenals and Tottenhams right now. You have your big clubs that are not necessarily at the top in maybe a Roma and an AC Milan. And I can't include Inter there now, Alex. I think they're on the rise back, but where there can be a little parity in the league. Like Atalanta, I think, are a great, great story. I kind of like an Atalanta to Leicester City right now. Obviously didn't win Serie A, Atalanta, like Leicester City won the Premier League, but where there's an open spot, there might be a couple open spots for surprise and deserving teams to challenge with some of the bigger dogs, if you will. And also, I mean, if there's going to be a Premier League snob who kind of turns himself away to Serie A, I would just say, well, you probably have a player you like in the Premier League right now that came from Serie A. And in a different fashion than saying, well, good players also come from Ligue 1. Like, I'm not here to do the what league is the best, what league is the worst debate, but Serie A and the Premier League have had a pretty close connection, especially the last handful of years of transfers going both directions and quality ones at that. So I think really style of play as well has some carryover. Both leagues can be fairly physical from time to time as well. Bundesliga and Ligue 1, you think of as a bit more open, a bit more free-flowing, and really not much defense. La Liga, it's a very imbalanced league, and I like all the leagues. I'm just saying, I think there are a lot more parallels to both leagues than maybe some fans realize.
Very well said, and I hope to see both leagues and all the big leagues back very soon. So we do have new information as of earlier today. We're recording this on Sunday. New information from the Italian Prime Minister Conte on, you know, how the country is beginning to phase out their social distancing restrictions. And, you know, this does have an impact, guys, on Serie A. As it stands, you know, assuming these guidelines don't change, because, you know, this stuff can be very fluid when you're dealing with a pandemic. But as it stands, individual training can begin again on May 4th. That's, you know, kind of a weird where guys can't really train together. But then group training is going to be able to resume likely on May 18th. And then Italian league games, we're not sure if it would be Serie A resuming first or Coppa Italia resuming first. But we're likely going to see games being played again on June 2nd with empty stadiums, of course. I think it's going to be several months yet before fans are allowed back in. So with all that said, I want to get Alex's take on this. And I also want to get Jerry's take to see if his opinion has changed as of today versus a couple days ago. So, Alex, assuming we're going to get a resolution to the Serie A season, we're going to see the season concluded. You know, we have what is basically a two-team Scudetto race. I'm not completely counting out my Inter, although they're, you know, they're 9 points back of first with a game in hand. So maybe 6 points back if you look at it optimistically. But you've got Juventus on top, a point in front of Jerry's Lazio. So, Alex, assuming we get, you know, a conclusion to the season, who do you see there pulling out and winning that Scudetto?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I want to say Lazio because I actually feel like they've been the better team this season. I feel like they've been the best team in Serie A. I'm just worried about the break and what the break does for Lazio's momentum, because they've had a riding momentum pretty much for the whole season. I know it didn't start off fantastic, but once they got going, they really got going. And I think they were really thriving off their momentum. Good, gritty away wins, sometimes really powerful wins away, and especially at home. So when you compare them on paper to Juve, yes, Lazio have a good squad, but I mean, no one's going to be as deep as Juve. No one's going to be as experienced as Juve. So I do worry that if you now put things all back to square one, which, I mean, no one did on purpose, but that's what the pandemic probably is doing, and everybody can get fit to a certain extent. So things kind of even out a little bit more than when the season is actively going on. I feel like considering Juve are right there, I mean, they're a point ahead. I feel like I got to go with Juve. Now, that's not me saying I don't think Lazio have a chance. I mean, maybe they can just regenerate that momentum fairly easily. Maybe they're just such a good team this season that I'm really overplaying the momentum card. But Juve, I know that they're a very imperfect team this season, and really saying that they're first in the league does not tell the whole story, especially if you compare it to past seasons. But I don't know. I feel like you give them almost a second chance. And what I mean by second chance is an opportunity to slow down Lazio's momentum, to not overuse that word, and see the fact that, all right, we are a point clear and we got a little bit here to finish the season. Let's go win another Scudetto. And they have certainly the players to do it. I will go with Juve, but I'm excited. I'm excited because knowing me, and the weird thing on Calcioland, for anybody that listens, I've been supporting Lazio and encouraging them and rating them, all the while also not fully believing in them. I've been doing kind of the double. I've been like covering my tracks, but also trying to take credit for any success they have. So I'm really trying to eat my cake, or have my cake and eat it too, excuse me. So I'm sure that if Serie A resumes and Juve have a draw and Lazio have a win, I'm going to be pounding my chest and saying, no, nope, I knew Lazio could do it. But no, if you want my honest opinion right this second, if I had to place money on one team and it was about even money, so I wasn't playing good odds, I would place it on Juve.
Yeah, I agree with you. And for all the reasons you stated, and I, you know, part of it for me is Juve being so battle tested and having won it 8 straight times. And I know not all the players are the same as the ones who, you know, won it there 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. But the experience factor is there. The momentum factor with Lazio makes a lot of sense. And you know, I know as an Interista, some people were surprised to hear me say I expected Juve to win it. But I'll tell you, a lot of people were very surprised in our previous episode that Jerry also thinks it's Juve's Scudetto to likely pull out and win over Lazio. You still feel that way, Jerry, or have you kind of gotten over that craziness?
I don't feel that way, actually. I think Lazio can win it still. I do believe that. So there was something, when we went off air, there was one thing that really caught my mind, is the fact that Lazio is right now still in Italy. The whole club is still there, and with Inter and Juventus, they need to come. A lot of their players are overseas. They're in other countries. They have to come back. They need to self-quarantine for 14 days. And there's a lot of disruption to their training in the next couple of weeks now. Whereas Lazio, they are going to start on May 4th. Everyone's going to be training individually. And as soon as, I believe, May 18th or whatever the date is set for them,
May 18th.
To set as a whole club, they are ready to go, and Lotito has this planned. And Lucas Leiva was reported on Football Italia, was he was stating that he wanted to go back to Brazil. And Lotito said, no, you're not going back, because here are the circumstances. If you do go back to Brazil, you're not going to be able to come back to the country. You're going to have to go through the quarantine process. You have to go through all this bullshit that you don't want to go through. So he stayed back in Italy with his family. He wasn't happy at the time, but I'm pretty sure now looking back, he probably did the best thing for his family and staying in Italy, which was the safest thing. So, and staying in his house. So for me, I just think that Lotito and the management has really kept everything in check. The players are safe. They're quarantined. They're doing what they have to, and they're preventing themselves from any exposure. And I've been watching videos of Luis Alberto in his house training really intensely. Joaquin Correa is trying really hard to stay focused. These players are hungry, and the fact that they're only 1 point back at Juventus, I still think they can still do it. And the momentum, yeah, maybe the momentum is not there right now, but as soon as they hit the field and they walk on, the first thing they're thinking is, we have a chance to win a Scudetto here, guys. We are 1 point back at Juventus. Everybody in the world doubted us. And the fact that we still have 12 games or whatever is left in the season, and the only biggest competition they have left, I would say, is Napoli and Juventus, in my opinion.
Right.
And if they can win those matches, it's game on for Lazio. And they have shown this season that they are much stronger in the midfield than Juventus is. And if they, even if they have 5 substitutions, if that's the new rule, one thing they can't substitute is that midfield. It is all freaking garbage. And you got a Luis Alberto and Milinkovic Savage will all play all 5 substitutions. I'll tell you that much. So for me, I will take Lazio still. And if I'm a betting man, I would take the odds, because there's a lot of good pay out of that.
Well, and you touched on it, by the way, that Juventus and Lazio still have a head-to-head. I don't know exactly when that's going to take place. It was supposed to take place this past weekend. I don't know when that match is actually going to take place, but when it does, that's going to be, you know, the game of the quote-unquote season, or at least the post-quarantine season. That's going to be a mega, mega, mega matchup. So let's get into a Chelsea deep dive here with Alex Goldberg. Now, Alex, before we get to full-on Chelsea, I do want to kind of bridge the gap a little bit with Serie A when we talk about some of Chelsea's recent coaches who tend to migrate their way back into Serie A. I've got to ask you about Antonio Conte first. I've been getting the full Conte experience this season, and that comes with a little bit of everything, right? It comes with the looniness and the crazy post-match rants. It comes with, you know, really pulling 100% out of a lot of his players and recovering players like Antonio Candreva, who looked like a dead man walking under Spalletti. And you've gotten mixed results on the pitch, but a lot of color comes with Conte. So I've got to ask you, what have been your impressions of what Conte's doing at Inter? And is he the exact same Conte that he was a few seasons ago with Chelsea? Or have you seen any sort of evolution either with his tactics or his personality off the pitch?
Yeah, I mean, I think Conte overall is a leopard who does not change his spots like leopards don't. So, you know, and I mean that in a good way and a bad way. I mean, there might be tweaks here and there, but I think tweaks here and there are just down to personnel. But already, I mean, Victor Moses, Ashley Young, like there are moves that just scream classic Antonio Conte, no matter what the year is. And as we always love to kind of joke about, but we're very serious about it as well in Calcioland, is Antonio Conte is also always going to be someone that when the result doesn't go his way, he's going to pretty much blame it on the board or just make sure you know at home that he might not have a good enough squad. But the brilliant part about Antonio Conte is that he can do a lot with a little. Now, I'm not saying Inter's squad is not good. I mean, he's obviously got some really good players, but I think, first of all, that Antonio Conte has done a very good job with Inter, because even though a lot of people pegged Inter to maybe challenge Juventus this season, like I'm thinking back to the takes of, all right, Conte has been appointed Inter manager, and now we think, especially with Juve going through a change themselves, Inter could rival Juve this season. I still think everybody should have realized the difference in squad that Juve and Inter had. And Antonio Conte has his vision, and he makes the team the way that makes sense to him, but he still overachieves a lot. Like, I still think if you look at the squads, you compare these squads on paper, he still overachieves. And by the way, one of the main reasons why people floated out that Inter could rival Juve is because of their back four, their presumed back four heading into the season. We all kind of got excited when we knew, okay, Handanovic will be the goalkeeper, and there'll be a three-man defense of Skriniar, who everyone rates, and Stefan de Vrij, who's just so solid and so good, and Diego Godin, who's coming over from Atletico Madrid. It's going to be this brilliant, brilliant back four. Now, they've obviously been a good team defensively, like all Inter teams are. However, Diego Godin has not had that good of a season. So it really even hasn't been for the exact reason that many people guessed. So when one of your senior players, one of still your better players on paper in Godin, I know he's up there in age, isn't even one of your best performers. And you think about, well, all right, like we have parts here, but besides Lautaro and Lukaku, on paper, we don't have many actual stars. So you got to take that into consideration. Now, some of that is Antonio Conte's choosing. Like, I always think back to the squad he took to Euros with Italy, and I think it was the Euros, and he just chooses to sometimes not go for the top talents, but he does want also top talents that fit his team. So to answer your question on like change in tactics, not really, nothing consistent. Like, this is still a guy who wants his wing backs. He wants somebody who can bomb forward, but also know his defensive responsibilities. I mean, it's funny. I never thought about Ashley Young being an Antonio Conte player, because Ashley Young was just always a United player. And when Conte was in the Premier League, he obviously was at Chelsea. So it never dawned on me, but like, that's a classic Antonio Conte player. especially with what Young plays these days, even at United. And he made Victor Moses, who Victor Moses is, as we all know, like a true wing back. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's been, you know, to fully answer the question in an even more long-winded way, I think where they are on the table and just everything that's happened this season is kind of exactly who Antonio Conte is. The team's not good enough. It really isn't good enough at the end of the day to be up there at 63 points with Juve, but they're still doing pretty well. And there's been ups and downs, but really, if you look at the stats, they kind of fit in line with what an Antonio Conte team embodies. So, yeah, I haven't seen too much change personality-wise as well. Like I said, I mean, passionate guy, and he can be a guy you absolutely love when things are going well, and he can be a guy that gets you pretty pissed off when things aren't going well.
Well, for people who know me and listen to the show, I think Conte is a bitch, and that's just the way I feel about him. I just think he's a little bitch that just likes to cry and moan, and you can give him gold, and he still won't be happy enough. But this summer, we saw Mauricio Sarri and Chelsea FC mutually agree part ways and terminate Sarri's contract. The Italian decided to sign with Juventus, and in his one season with the club with Chelsea, he was pretty successful. He won the Europa League and finished fourth in the EPL as well. So there were some good results that he brought to Chelsea in his 1 year as manager. So, Alex, what were your thoughts on Maurizio Sarri's one season with Chelsea, and were you disappointed that he had left Chelsea this summer?
Yeah, I'll make my answer more on the brief side because I could speak all day about it. I mean, it was an up-and-down season for Sarri, no doubt about it, at Chelsea. He was somebody that was appointed to really actually change Chelsea and have more of a long-term vision, taking a much more defensive-style club for all the years they had Mourinho and Conte, and to try and make it his own. And it actually started off really well, which many people thought actually would start off poorly and eventually get good, but it started off well. But then once they faced some adversity, I think you saw one of the big flaws with Maurizio Sarri, that he doesn't really have a plan B, but he doesn't choose to have a plan B. He purposely just chooses to have a really good plan A. But I think he had a little bit of a rude awakening, and this is where I don't want to sound snobby about the Premier League, and I don't even mean it in this way, but you can't have no adaptability in the Premier League. You just can't. So I think he certainly was kind of hit with some cold, hard truths there in the middle of the season. And then, like he should have known, when you don't do well at Chelsea, you're going to come under a lot of fire from within the club, from, of course, the media, but it's a place that is very unforgiving towards their managers. So he realized that quickly, but one huge personality trait that he has and Antonio Conte have is they're stubborn. They're stubborn. They believe in their vision, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. So he definitely started to butt heads. Even he has said recently his time in the dressing room was not always that great. I mean, he certainly wasn't always getting along swimmingly with maybe some of the players. I mean, there was no outright feud, but it just felt like immediately he was already on borrowed time, especially in the club's vision. I mean, he nearly got sacked in that Carabao Cup final game. If Chelsea had really been spanked that night by Manchester City, he would have been sacked the next day, but they actually had quite a good performance. And for any Serie A fan who's like, what game are you talking about? It was the game that Kepa refused to come off the pitch. And I'm sure everybody now knows what game I'm talking about, where Kepa and Sarri were pretty much arguing with each other from 100 yards away. But that actually was a turning point for Maurizio Sarri. He handled that well. He didn't get sacked, like I said, because the team actually faced Manchester City impressively. And he kind of saved face. And I would be lying, though, if I said that he did all the heavy lifting to turn it around and eventually go on and win the Europa League. He had one of the best players in the world do an absolute masterclass of a season. And Eden Hazard just had a truly phenomenal season, 16 goals and 15 assists in the Premier League with like no one to pass the ball to or receive it from. And that's not me being biased. That's me spitting facts. I mean, I think he had 49% of the goal contributions that season. I mean, now maybe that happens for like a bad team, but find me somebody who contributes to 49% of the goals, either with a goal or an assist on a team that ends up winning a title. And it just doesn't happen. So it was a pretty big carry job, but Sarri kept the ship upright and got third place and got the Europa League trophy, his first ever trophy. And he really leaves on terms that most Chelsea managers don't get to leave on. Good terms. Doesn't really happen. You either get sacked or you walk away, but under a really toxic term or manner. And it was more the perfect storm of things as to why he left. I mean, obviously, Juve went through a change in manager, and Sarri was definitely feeling homesick to a certain extent. I don't think the toxicity and turmoil that happened months before in England helped that situation. But when that job became available, this is somebody who probably in the back of his head always wanted to have a job like that. No disrespect to Napoli. We all know Sarri's story and where he came from. It was just kind of the perfect storm, to use that term again, of, well, you know, if I stay at Chelsea, I'll probably be sacked eventually because that's just what happens. And I'm much more comfortable in Italy, and Juve's always got a great squad. I can probably go win another trophy and really turn my career, not around, because that's a, that's kind of an insult to what he did at Napoli, but I can really accelerate my career here and kind of change the narrative of I'm a manager who doesn't win anything. And he took it. And as a Chelsea fan, for me, that was fine. That was fine. I felt very indifferent on it. If he wanted to stay and the club was going to back him, okay. But if he's kind of feeling like he already has one foot out the door, well, I don't want you there if you already feel like you have one foot out the door. So we have a transfer ban, and there's a manager who we like for personal reasons, but also would probably be the most appropriate manager for a transfer ban and having to play youth. Let's do it. So it's very rare in this sport, this industry, that things make sense for both parties. But I think in this case, it did.
No, you provide really good points, and I agree with what you're saying with Mauricio Sarri. He is a stubborn old man that just believes in plan A, and if you don't have a plan B, and especially in the EPL, you will get chewed apart, and you will, and it showed at times last season. And with Hazard, there was one game, I believe, against, it was against West Ham. I believe he went through like four or five players and scored an individual goal. And that sums up what Hazard did for Chelsea last year. That one game where he scored that goal, and he scored countless goals like that, where he had to take the play to him by himself and just take Chelsea to the next level. And you're right. If it wasn't for Hazard last season, they probably wouldn't have won Europa League, and they probably wouldn't have finished in fourth as well in the league. He really was the difference. But they had decided to replace Maurizio Sarri with club legend Frank Lampard. And the 41-year-old had agreed to a 3-year deal, which we will see him at least until June 2022. So upon arriving, the club had been sanctioned a transfer ban and were unable to purchase players in the summer transfer window. What were your thoughts of Lampard being appointed the new manager of Chelsea? And did you think he was the right person to manage the squad given the circumstances the club was in?
I have an ability to overtalk, but I could really just answer your question by saying yes. But I'll give a little background. I mean, Chelsea have had a phenomenal academy for a long, long time. And if there's anything they've struggled with, it's not winning trophies. They've always managed to win trophies, even in bad seasons. But it's to have stability and to kind of have more of a clear direction and foundation. They really just have won trophies based on being a big club, quote unquote, and just always having some players that have championship pedigree and also having some just great players. But they've been such a interesting team, you could put it, with a lot of turmoil and toxicity from year to year. And also a team that was just always producing this great young talent, but choosing to never use them for anything but a business model and just to profit off of, oh, we'll send them on loan and their careers will probably get stagnated, but we'll still be able to sell them for about £10. And we'll just keep doing this with all of the talent we produce. And we're going to make a lot of money off of it. And we win these youth trophies anyway, so we make some money there, but it's a business for us. But it was just time, because you can't keep sending these players on loan, actually have them do well at now clubs that people have heard of, like a lot of Chelsea's youngsters last season, and all the while continue to have these ups and downs. And also other clubs, other big clubs, show interest in these players. It's about time we see if they can make it at our club. And if we have a transfer ban and we have a manager that also might be leaving us and Maurizio Sarri, well, I think it's time to hire a manager as well who knows the club, knows how important using these players could be, and is willing to use these players. And by the way, his assistant manager, Mr. Jody Morris, managed all these players at academy level. I mean, I hate to keep using this term that I used the answer ago with Maurizio Sarri, but it's all part of the same story. It was a perfect storm. It was the exact reasoning Chelsea would need to use the youth and finally hire someone like Frank Lampard, whose CV, his resume managerial-wise, was almost incomplete. 1 year at Derby, and you can debate if it was good, okay, or not good. But he was the manager to use youth and to know the youth and to know what the club needs. So I think the only last reason why I think the club went with it and why I was also really okay with it that I'll give is how damn good Liverpool and Manchester City are. It almost helped, because if they felt like, oh, the league's wide open, I don't think they would have done it. I don't think they would have hired Frank Lampard. I think they would have hired a more experienced manager. I think they would have actually, they did appeal the ban, but they didn't ask CAS to actually freeze the ban. So I think they would have tried to get it frozen. I think they would have went after senior players and tried to piece it together and contend for the title and probably neglect most of the youth because the league would be wide open. But because Manchester City and Liverpool have just been so clear, it almost helped. It almost helped Chelsea realize, well, no, now is the time, for all the reasons that I just mentioned, to maybe take one step back, but then to take two, three, maybe even four forward. So I was okay with it. I was excited by it. I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, you probably know I'm a pretty big fan of a lot of Chelsea's youngsters, and I'm obviously a Frank Lampard fan, so I was certainly okay with it, and I am still okay with it. I'm glad it happened.
And you know, I find myself really rooting for Lampard to do well there, because I just, something, I think I'm an optimist at the end of the day, and just the idea of a club legend succeeding as manager of that club, there's something really romantic about that. So, I mean, with that said, Alex, I'd love kind of your progress report on Lampard and Chelsea in his first season at the helm. Now, they currently find themselves fourth place in the EPL. They've advanced to the round of 16 in Champions League. They're in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup. So I don't know if you could give a letter grade, and obviously, you know, incomplete, but, you know, because the campaign is not concluded. But if you can give Chelsea and Lampard a letter grade to this point, what would that be and why?
Give them a B+. You know, you got to take in all the context. I think the most important context is the transfer ban and the fact that you lost Eden Hazard, who, as I say, had 49% of your goal contributions last season, and you couldn't really replace him. Yes, you had Christian Pulisic all signed up last January, so he was coming no matter what, but still, he's not Eden Hazard, and you had no ability to do anything else. You were able to officially sign Kovacic, but he was still a player that was on the team the previous season. So you had no ability to really bring players in. All your rivals did. And also, really, there was no chance for Chelsea to give Lampard the free hit of a season that everybody said he would have. Now, on one hand, you could argue that and say, well, yes, because no one expects them to win the title. And that is true. But, I mean, beyond that, no one was. Everyone said, well, if Chelsea are going to finish 8th or 9th or 10th this season, that's fine. No one will blame them for it. We all know that's not true. So you can take all the context and say, oh, he kind of gets a free hit. I'm not saying he would have been sacked if Chelsea were in 8th, 9th, or 10th. I don't believe that. I do think he had some special freedom that past managers haven't had, but he would have been bashed and barreled and really beaten down at this point if they truly were in 8th, 9th, or 10th. There's just such pressure being the Chelsea manager. So that's important context to just remember as well. And then I give him a B+ because I thought he actually had a good overall season as a manager. I liken him to all the young players at Chelsea this season. It really, like all of them, they all had their moments where they showed you great promise and great performances. Like, I think Lampard had two great games as a manager against Jose Mourinho and Tottenham, and certainly has had some good moments as a manager this season. I think he's had really good player management skills, man management skills, where sometimes he's benched players and they've come back a lot more focused and a lot more just locked in. So I think that's a huge part to his managerial status that shouldn't surprise someone that he's good at, because he was just a player not too long ago, and he's very relatable and personable anyway. But I think he's really excelled there tactically. Like I said, he's had some good games where you're like, wow, that was a tactical masterclass from him. I think I give him a B+, though, on the negative side, because he's overmanaged at times. And I think he'll learn that. Sometimes he's switched formations too much. Sometimes he's stuck with the same formation when it should have been switched. But he's accountable, and it feels like he never just kept persisting in a negative way at the same thing. So really, he just had a lot of things working against him. And he finds himself in fourth place, which was really the peak. That was the absolute top position people were guessing going into the season. So the expectation was, for me, fourth to seventh, from many, fifth to eighth. Like, that was many people's prediction, fifth to eighth. And he has Chelsea in fourth. So how could you give him much worse than a B+, just remembering the context heading into the season, what he was working against? And then last thing, Chelsea have suffered the most significant injuries. Significant injuries means a player being out for either 10 to 14 days or missing one, I think it's a minimum of one game, might be minimum of two games, but significant injuries. They've suffered the most this season, and that's not including Callum Hudson-Odoi and Ruben Loftus-Cheek's Achilles injuries that stem back from last season. And maybe someone could say, oh, he's overworking them in training, it's his fault. Everyone I've spoken to says, no, it's really just more of a freak thing. So he hasn't had players like N'Golo Kanté for long stretches of the season, Christian Pulisic for long stretches of the season, Callum Hudson-Odoi for long stretches of the season. These aren't just players that are not available. These are really good players that are not available. So really gets even more impressive looking at the fourth place standing when you see some of the players that he's been rolling out there each week. I mean, Chelsea, last game they played before this pandemic hit was against Everton, won 4-0. And if you look at the squad he rolled out there, starting Pedro and Willian and and Barkley, a bunch of players that you would never write into your ideal starting 11 for Chelsea, it only gets more impressive. And by the way, he's been able to do this while doing the one thing that was paramount if you hired Lampard: introduce youth. And he's been able to do that and literally build now a foundation for fans to feel happy about and for the club to profit off of financially, because without boring you with finances, when you have young players in your squad, it saves you money because you don't have to pay that amortization fee. So he's just done a lot for the club already. As a really smart writer for The Telegraph pointed out to me on my podcast, Matt Law, he has saved the club now, or made the club, however you want to look at it, millions and millions of pounds by proving that these youngsters, Tammy Abraham, Mason Mount, et cetera, are Premier League players. So B+, absolutely.
And that's so well said. And it's also a perfect segue to my next question. When you talk about youth and you talk about the academy players, which have been doing so well, and Chelsea, as you've mentioned, has a great academy. If you can pick one, which player do you feel has made the most impact this season from the academy?
Wow, that's such a good question. So impact, I can't say someone like Reece James because his season started a little bit late. And I can't say Callum Hudson-Odoi because he's dealt with injuries. And I can't say Billy Gilmore because he just blossomed at the very end of the season. So it does whittle it down a lot. And I can't really say Fikayo Tomori because he's been phased out for the second half of the season, even though he's had a good overall first season with Chelsea. And Reece James has been phenomenally impressive. And Callum Hudson-Odoi has struggled at times, but still has 4 assists for Chelsea. And I think that's still tied. No, maybe Willian has 5. But he's even shown really good flashes in limited time. So it does whittle it down to 2, which helps me for this answer. Tammy Abraham or Mason Mount? Tammy Abraham has the stats on his side. I mean, 13 goals, 3 assists, and really kind of proved that there is no number 9 curse and that he could be the starting striker for Chelsea now and, more importantly, in the future. And really, until the last month or so of the season, where he was injured and just looked kind of overran and fatigued, really looked like someone who, wow, can this guy get 20 goals a season? Because those 13 goals, by the way, no pens for those 13 goals. So that it was extra impressive as well. But on the flip, Mason Mount, 6 goals, 4 assists, and played more of an honest midfielder, really could have had more to that 6-4. Mason Mount even though he wasn't maybe the player of the season for Chelsea, I think that was Mateo Kovacic, Mason Mount was asked to do the most this season, played in the most games in the Premier League for Chelsea, and played in by far the most positions. He played as an 8, he played as a 10, he played as a left winger, he played as a right wing, well, maybe not a right winger, but he certainly played as a right inside forward, also a left inside forward, sometimes a shadow striker. I mean, he played everywhere, played the most, was by far the defensive leader out there, not in terms of a center back or goalkeeper, but in terms of pressing, which is a huge identity to Lampard. He was always the one kind of leading everyone to how to do the closing down angles, how to press in a certain way, in a certain style. And I'm talking about waving on players like N'Golo Kante and Mateo Kovacic and Willian and Pedro. Those are all players who actually are known to have really good work rates. So that's vastly, vastly impressive and really beyond what a 20 and 21 year old should be asked to do in the Premier League. But obviously the background Mason Mount had with Frank Lampard the season before at Derby helped, but he really was asked to kind of be more of a senior player while having his first season in the Premier League. So it's tough. I think it's really tough. At the end of the day, I will say Tammy, because goals win you games, and he had 13 goals, no pens, scored in a variety of ways and scored some big ones. I mean, I'm not saying Mount didn't necessarily. He did have a nice winner against Aston Villa and he performed great both times Chelsea played Spurs. But I mean, Tammy Abraham, when he gets a winner against Arsenal to end the game and in a comeback win, I think I'd probably give him the tiebreaker there. So yeah, I mean, either of those two really were, I mean, I think really, if you were to poll any Chelsea fan on just top overall players this season for Chelsea, besides your young, immature kids who for some reason hate on Mason Mount on Twitter, I think if you were to just go to a sensible fan, I think they would throw Tammy and Mount certainly in the top 5 performers for Chelsea this season. And if you said youngsters, I mean, they would have to be 1 and 2 just because they were such consistent performers for Chelsea. So I'm glad you worded it that way, Alex, because if you said like flash in a pan youngster or who just in a vacuum impressed you the most, I could have skewed it and said, well, Reece James, because he immediately looked like maybe the best player for Chelsea week in, week out. But in terms of consistently impacted and helped Chelsea, yeah, I think you got to go with Tammy Abraham or Mount, and I'll go with Tammy for a tiebreaker.
No, absolutely. They both have been really good for Chelsea this year. And one player who was really good for Chelsea last season was Callum Hudson-Odoi. And his season ended with an Achilles injury. And this is an injury that you have repeatedly have said on your show. It's not an injury that's easy to come back from. And it takes time for a player to regain his form when they get this injury. So that it really has changed the player's career. Now, this year, he has returned to the club, but hasn't been nearly the same as he was last year. And that's due to the fact that he's missed a lot of playing time. And the four has put in mixed performances as he's shown to play at a high level, as well as at a level that shows his form is not there yet. Now, I feel that this season, he's been treated really, really unfairly. And a lot of the fans at times have really gone after him and to me, it's just something that they have to understand that this is a player that needs time to get back to his form. And so my question for you is that, do you feel that Callum has been treated unfairly this season? And do you expect him to regain the form that he showed last season?
Yes. I mean, I totally expect him to get back to what we thought he would be currently doing. I think people don't know enough about the Achilles injury. It is such a tough injury, even when you're backed. I mean, look at any sport. Players don't usually feel like themselves, have that kind of out of their head mentally for a year after. I mean, the stats are there to prove it. And it can be a very frightening thing because it was such an innocent injury in the first place, just kind of came down. It wasn't even awkward. And boom, just ruptured his Achilles. And it was definitely gutting for him. And I think, yeah, at moments, I mean, he came back and actually was phenomenal. When he came back, he actually hit the ground running. But I just think that there's always there's tightness in your Achilles. I know for a fact he had a lump on his Achilles, which is normal, but you just don't feel, you might look like yourself to a fan on Twitter who can say, look at Hudson Adoy with the techers here, the nice tricks here, and can make a 10-second clip out of it. But that doesn't mean like you're consistently feeling like yourself. And he also was kind of thrown in the fire. I mean, he wasn't thrown back into a team that had a bunch of senior players like Eden Hazard and Diego Costa and Cesc Fabregas, and he could kind of ease back in. Once he was fit and ready to go, he was somebody that Lampard needed to play quite a lot. And, you know, if you then have a few bad games in a row, things can really start to wear on you. And you're already dealing with the Achilles injury mentally, but now you're dealing with the fact that people know you got this new contract, people know what you should be, and it can snowball almost in a bad way where you're getting in your own head. But he did turn things around to a certain extent in terms of performances right before he pulled up with a hamstring injury, which, by the way, is I had an injury guru, if you will, Ben Dinnery, on my podcast last week. And that's so common. You come back from like a major injury and you often then get a little injury after because you're kind of overcompensating, maybe easing off one part of your body and putting a little bit more stress and pressure on the other part. But you know, that's minor. He would have obviously been totally back now if it weren't for the pandemic. But I mean, he's just insanely talented and he's 19 and he is a confident kid. So yeah, you might snowball in your head a little bit with the flack you're getting for not being Mbappe right away. But he is somebody that when thrown back out there, especially with this team who's got such a great spirit, all of his mates out there anyway, and a manager that believes in him, he's somebody that's going to go exude confidence and really will hit the ground running. I mean, I have no doubt about it. He's so young still, and now he has plenty of adversity. I mean, he's got some experience now under his belt, but also plenty of adversity, which I think will go a long way. I think the sooner you experience adversity, the really more well-prepared you'll be for, say, a bad game in the future, and the more likely it doesn't turn into a long slump. So I think he's in the right situation. He's on the right team to feel confident, feel backed, and be able to go express himself. And he still is going to be a very key player for Lampard. It's a young squad. Willian and Pedro are almost certainly both leaving. So really, it's there for the taking for him. And knowing him a little bit, knowing his family a little bit, he's confident and very excited to be a huge player for Chelsea. So, yeah, I just think the flack he gets and the stick he got on Twitter especially is just kind of a it's just kind of a symbol of what social media is like in 2020 and how reactionary people can be. But yeah, I fully back him to be what I've always thought he will be.
No, absolutely. And he is going to get his playing time that he was scared about last season before signing his contract. And with, like you just said, Willian and Pedro most likely gone with the club next season, not going to be there. This is a great opportunity for him going forward. And he is going to, I think he's going to shine with Chelsea and he's going to prove a lot of people wrong. And this Achilles injury is not going to hold him back because before he got hurt, this is a player who showed a true talent and displayed what he can be capable of. And he can score a lot as well. But what are your thoughts on what Chelsea will do in the transfer window come this summer? And now that the ban is lifted, will they go back to their old ways and bring in a bunch of players? Or do you think they'll rely more on their youth system?
A balance. It's always going to be much more dependent on youth than it has been in the past. But these guys won't always be youth forever, too. I mean, they will get to an older age. But yeah, I mean, I think Billy Gilmore being 18 years old and now being a player that already looks so good and promising that you have people talking about Jorginho's future. I mean, I think Lampard is always going to give deserving youth players a chance. Like he's going to give, the important part is he's not going to just give anything to these youth players, but these youth players are so good and so driven that he's going to have them in first team training. If he feels like their quality is there, they might not be in first day squads, like match day squads, but he's going to get them in the environment where if they impress him, they'll get the chance. So Chelsea have no shortage of them. I mean, they're still coming. Billy Gilmore, and a really impressive kid, Connor Gallagher, do really well on two different loans in the championship this season. They have a kid named Tino Andrin, who just kind of got his first exposure to the first team, made his Premier League debut right before the pandemic, and he's rated immensely highly. So there's always going to be that chance given. But obviously, you can only start so many young players in a team. You can only have so many. And they already have enough where there is now the opportunity, and they should, go out and buy some deserving, some quality senior players. What the youth does, without me once again going into a big financial talk, is when you're saving money on these youth players, as long as they're part of your squad, then you are obviously not, you know, so you have your Tammy, even if he was a backup, you're paying no amortization on him versus, say, Michi was your striker. You're paying an amortization on him and you have to pay him the weekly wage. So really having these players can prevent you from having to go sign your Michis, and no offense to Torino fans, but your Zappacostas and Bakayokos and Drinkwaters and all these players that you kind of knew were never going to be big players for you, but you kind of wanted to piece it together. You don't have to sign those players anymore, because worst case scenario, those young players will be your Zappacostas, your Drinkwaters and your Bakas, but probably much better. And now you should just be going to look for the big fish. You need a left back? Go sign a senior left back now. So I think there's always going to be a balance, to answer your question, Jerry. I mean, I think Lampard certainly does rate having experienced players. He rates balance. I mean, he played Willian and Rudiger once he came back from injury so much because he wanted balance. He, as much as he rates his young players, he didn't want to just play young players throughout, because you do need a good balance in your team of experienced players and just players from all different profiles. So he's certainly going to always still tell the club, hey, there's this 27-year-old that I think could be quality for us. Let's look into him. Cough, cough, Hakim Ziyech from Ajax. Like, that had Lampard's fingerprints all over. He saw him in the Champions League. He's known of him for a while. He wanted the club to sign him. Boom, they signed him. So there will be that balance. But compared to previous Chelsea teams and really what you've known of Chelsea, there'll be a lot more youth now and in the future. There's no doubt about it. And probably more than most teams are willing to use, because Lampard's assistant manager, Jody Morris, was the head of the youth academy for a long, or the head academy coach, at least, for a long, long time. And they're always going to be pro giving your own a chance.
Really good stuff, Alex, on Chelsea. And let me close the conversation with this. I've noticed a handful of times over the last couple of years on Calcioland with David, you've kind of teased the idea of adopting a Serie A club. To my recollection, you haven't committed to one, and I can understand that, because, like, I watch a lot of leagues and I don't necessarily root for any specific team in that league. But since you've teased it before, I'm curious, are you leaning in any direction at this moment on any Serie A club?
Lazio. Yeah, I really like Lazio. First of all, their white kit this season, whew, so nice. So if it has to be from an aesthetic point of view, I really like Lazio's look. But I got to be honest, David got me really drinking the cool, and he did not pressure me. And the only time we ever talked about Milinkovic-Savic was on air. So it's not like off air he was trying to have me buy the Milinkovic-Savic stock. But I really think he's a badass. Like, I really like Milinkovic-Savic, and he's kind of everything I like in a midfielder. And I just feel like he's a proper footballer, which is a little bit of a generic term, but I think really applies to him. But I just like their squad. Like, I've always liked Ciro Immobile, and I know he's a player that I wouldn't necessarily want to acquire for my own team. And that's no hit to him. I just know, I remember somebody for Lazio saying not too long back that Immobile does so well at Lazio because, like, socially, he just is very comfortable there. So it's just the perfect situation for him. But I really like Ciro Immobile as well. And I like kind of the contrast they have on their team. They're a fun team for me to watch. So Lazio, you know, I feel like they're also that perfect balance. I'm not fully in on them yet, but I'm almost trying to verbally convince myself right now. I just feel like they almost have that balance where they're a very, like, they're a very known team. Don't get me wrong. Like, they're absolutely a big Serie A club, for me to put that in quotes. I actually hate that term, but you know what I mean? Like, you could ask a fair weather fan in America, have you heard of Lazio? They've heard of them. They've definitely heard of them, but they're not necessarily, I mean, they're certainly not like your Juventus, where if you turn on FIFA, or I guess FIFA doesn't call them Juve anymore for contractual rights, but
yeah, whatever, Piemonte, you know, Calcio is what they are, right, now.
Exactly. But like, a young kid might just choose Juve because they want to play with Ronaldo and Dybala, and maybe the Milans to a certain extent, because it wasn't that long ago where they were powerhouses, might just have a lot of people choose them because they were that good. And you know, Roma, where I live in Boston, they almost have a carried over culture because of the owner having, you know, obviously times here in Boston. They've played some friendlies in Boston. And who else would I be forgetting here? I don't want to offend another top club, and I put that in quotes again. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't see it a lot. I don't see a lot of Lazio fans in my world around me a lot. So to kind of be one of those people who wants to not go against the grain, but not piggyback on another bandwagon, it just, I don't know, it just kind of feels like someone inside my head is telling me to be a Lazio fan. But I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. You know, I love really Jeremy Boga. I guess I disrespected Napoli. That's the team I forgot. But now I always liked Lorenzo Insigne and stuff. But if I didn't take the bait then, when I really liked Lorenzo, then I'm clearly not going to take it. Now, if Jeremy Boga goes to Napoli, we'll have a talk, because I really like Jeremy Boga. But right now I would say I'm leaning towards Lazio. But if you've listened to the podcast, you know, I almost went in on Milan. So, you know, I was getting a little bit enticed with them. So I'm still a free agent.
And I'm very glad, by the way, you didn't make that choice. I'd much rather you pick Lazio than Milan.
No, I agree. You know what? I'm not just saying this, Alex. I'm actually closer to Inter now than Milan. I mean,
well, there you go.
I really like Lautaro Martinez, and I would be overall closer to Inter. But yeah, I'm still a free agent. And right now I would just say I'm a player fan in Serie A. Like, I still love my Alexandro. I like Lautaro, as I said, quite a bit. Really like Milinkovic-Savic. Love Jeremy Boga. So for right now, no team has me, just players. But Lazio's the closest.
No, you're right. Being a Lazio fan, I don't know too many Lazio fans around here where I am. It's true. But you did say that Savic is badass and you really like him. So being a Chelsea fan and you being a Chelsea fan, would you think that Savic would be a good fit for Chelsea, and can you see him be a good fit for the EPL, or would you want Chelsea to neglect from even considering to purchase Milinkovic-Savic? Because we've seen so many times in the rumor mill that he has been pegged to becoming with Chelsea. So what would you think of this?
I would love it. I would absolutely love it. I mean, it would be a dream move for me. But here's what would have to happen. I'd get rid of Jorginho and N'Golo Kante to bring in Milinkovic-Savic. And it's not because I don't rate Jorginho and Kante. I obviously do, especially Kante. And I like Jorginho and rate him. But Chelsea now have a different direction they're going. And they also still have players like Mateo Kovacic, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Mason Mount, who play in the midfield, that it would just feel like a cluster, a quality cluster, if you had Jorginho and Kante and Milinkovic-Savic and Loftus-Cheek and Kovacic and Mount. And Ziyech can also play as a midfield, but not a necessary cluster. It just doesn't feel like that's a cohesive direction. So I certainly would want to get rid of one, but I would want to get rid of both, because it just doesn't feel like the smart move business-wise to even carry all of that. So, yeah, I would love Milinkovic-Savic at Chelsea. I really would, but Chelsea right now can't really acquire a midfielder until they... Oh, and by the way, I forgot Billy Gilmore, who's just a massive, massive part of Chelsea's future. He's not going anywhere. He's now a first-team member. No loan, no nothing. So he's a part of it as well. So that's another reason, just for the numbers game. Like, to get Milinkovic-Savic, I'd have to send two out the door. But I would, and I would love it.
I agree with you. I would send Conte out, yes. Cause not because I don't like him. He just... I think the injuries have really caught up to him now, and I don't remember the last season he had like a non-injury season. It's probably been, what, three years now, maybe, that he hasn't like been, he's been fully healthy for a year. So I think that would be the first player I would sell. And from there, yeah, you're right. You would have to get two, because you don't want to have a cluster of midfielders. Good point.
Yeah, and like what I like about Milinkovic-Savic is he can do a lot for you. Like, he's not a one-trick pony. He's really, I guess I also call him a proper midfielder, because he can do a lot in the midfield. He can obviously get forward, and he can score, and he can sauce with his dribbles, but he can put in a tackle, and he's just a midfielder. I think I'm using that in such a generic way, but he can just do a lot. And what I saw from Kovacic this last season, like, Kovacic is now also turning into a midfielder that's kind of a jack-of-all-trades midfielder. So, man, having them, and then Billy Gilmore, who kind of is like, he's not a regista, but he can be a regista, and just like a deep-lying midfielder who can really be composed and move from side to side, similar to how Jorginho does, but also be a little bit more capable putting in a tackle and bombing forward. Then you have your more attacking midfielders in Loftus-Cheek and Mount, who can play the 8 and the 10. Like, you get rid of Jorginho and Conte and still have those guys, and your midfield is still very versatile and can do a lot.
Really great stuff here. And we can't thank Alex enough for spending some time with us. Really, really great stuff on Chelsea and on Serie A. And Alex, let the people know, where can they find your Byline podcast and where can they find you on social media?
I appreciate that. It's been a pleasure. You can find my podcast on Patreon. So CalcioLand listeners might be familiar with Patreon. If they're not a patron of CalcioLand, they still have heard Patreon because David does talk about it, obviously, on our even free episodes, our regular episodes, you could say. So Patreon, just the Byline Show. The Byline Show on Patreon. Actually, that's embarrassing. I think it's just the Byline on Patreon. It's just the Byline on Patreon. Whatever. Type in Byline. You'll find it on Patreon. But actually, to cut out the middleman, just go to my Twitter, @AlexGoldberg_. You'll find anything you need, anything I just talked about on my Twitter. That is, I'm a one-man operation. So if there's anything you need to know or you want to watch or listen of mine, just go to my Twitter. That's home base, you could call it, @AlexGoldberg_. And proceed with caution. Sometimes I can be loud and annoying.
And also, he's humble, so he didn't bring it up, but he makes really good videos on his Twitter account as well. So people should check those out if they follow. And this is a really enjoyable episode. I think we should honestly do some more of this in mixing up some other leagues and some other teams. So make sure you follow Alex. Make sure you follow Jerry at JMancini8 on Twitter. And make sure you follow me @AlexDono. We'll talk to everyone next time on the Calcio Connection. Ciao.